again, 854 people today. Well, baby was just born to the Kashaya people, but they are strong people today. And that's what I would love to share with you about that. They lived up in the hillsides. They did not live on the plains of Fort Ross. They were very seasonal, however. Their territory is very small. And so they did have seasonal places within that small territory. Sometimes they would go to the ocean when they knew the moon was full and it was a spring tide and tides were low, and gather seaweed and salts and, you know, whatever else they could gather. They didn't live there. They didn't live on the coast. And I can agree, I live on the coast, and it's not great to live on the coast. You might think it is because it's a beautiful view, but it's, you know, you're kind of cold all the time, a little bit. Not like, unless you find that sun in that moment. But they lived on the other side of the hills where the acorn, the tanuk, is their life. And they could gather and live, and that's where their villages were. There were three villages associated with Fort Ross, and those three chiefs are the ones that signed a declaration, a contract, a treaty. It's called a treaty with the Russians. And I think I mentioned this before, but I want to say again, it's the only treaty in California history that was ever upheld. And that is a wow. It is really powerful. And again, the Kashaya embrace that fact. And they take that seriously. Even though what was paid for the land, so to speak, the Kashaya don't own land in that way that we think of owning land. They do now. But they were paid for to allow the Russians to have this land. And it was, three pairs of pants. Breeches is what they were called, and it's to the three chiefs. Three pairs of pants, three axes, a handful of beads, three blankets, and other trinkets that they just loved. And then also friendship coins that we have reproduced that were given to them to prove that they are friends of the Russians. And actually, they used those coins whenever there was a moment of a neighboring tribe coming in saying, look, now remember this, because I want you to tell the Spanish to stay, you know, a distance, and that we have the friendship of the Russians and the protection. And they felt that it was a protective symbol that they had with the company. So they lived more in the hillside, and their land, the Kashaya, is quite large, although also we're just looking at all of the Pomo. And Pomo is a language grouping of people from anthropologists. But there's different tribal names, but you can see the Kashaya, Casadero, it's up in that region where that white line is. Do you see the white line? And then you have the southern of the, northern, southern. But I don't know, what is here in Calistoga? What people were native people here? The Wapu? Wapu. And so they had quite an area that they lived, and there's actually a work going on right now with Caltrans to do place names of all of the place names in the Kashaya territory so that we can have their names instead of all the European names with it. They are hunters and gatherers. They would come to low tide. They did live on the bluff, but generally they didn't stay there. They lived, like I said, over on the other side. So I want to show you a couple of the historic images. I have mixed this with some historic images in modern day. This one is the California Indians in the Ross vicinity, and their regalia is exactly the same of the regalia that they wear today. And we have had a recent, what's called a big time, it's their celebration. The Kashaya have been coming in more to Fort Ross and dancing and showing themselves. And you can see these headdresses. They're very typical of what a lot of actually California, Northern California Indians would have worn as well. So some of the earliest historic images are very valuable to us today. For many reasons, ethnographic studies, learning of what was worn and what was collected. And the largest collection is in the Kunstkammer. And I'll be talking about that in a moment. This is another group. Now, this is 1880s. The Russians left in 1841. And I'm just showing you, I want to share with you how the clothing progressed and how the look progressed and changed. And I'll go back first to, had mentioned about clothing and women. You know, you don't want to stand out in a group. That's not human nature necessarily, unless you're just eccentric and you want to do that. But a Kashaya woman that would have intermarried into the population with an Alaskan or Russian man would have obviously known that her clothing is not what the colony is wearing and would have adapted. And if been asked, and it probably was asked of, to wear European clothing, and it might be more comfortable, truthfully. I mean, you know, wearing a bark skirt is itchy. I'm sure they're used to it, but wearing a sarafan, oh, that's cloth. And also it's a sign of, in a way, not wealth, but growth, and to wear the cloth. And in fact, Kashaya men would come into and around the fort area after a night of gaming with Russians and wearing three shirts because they would win. And it was a sign of show. It was showing, you know, an adornment. And that would be very typical. Women would have adapted. You adapt. You know, when you go to someone's house and they take their shoes off, that household at the door, you take your shoes off, right? And you adapt. You just do, because you want to fit in. And that would have been true of the women. And I'm going to point out a couple things. I don't have a pointer, so forgive me. But you can see a sarafan right here. And that's even in 1880s. And a lot of them are wearing either sarafan and then the headscarves, right? Mm-hmm. Very, very typical. And the other dress is a kamlaika. A kamlaika is a garb of a native Alaskan. And it would have been made of seal gut or cloth, and they adapted it to be the cloth clothing, like a muumuu. I get to go to work in a muumuu sometimes because it's my costume. It's like, yeah, it's comfy. And so I just wanted you to see that some of those ways of dressing remain, that everyday life, for a long time. And that was what they took on, and they took it as a part of their culture. And you can see also the redwood hut. That's a very typical redwood hut. That was in 1880. And I think that's amazing, because they're still living a very traditional lifestyle even at that time, 40 years after the Russians left, because they had very little impact. Because after the Russians left, the ranchers came in. I wanted to show you, too, just kind of an outburst, just a like a wow. This person who did this drawing was, you know, kind of not cartoonish, but he stood out amongst the ethnographic guys. They didn't really like him because they didn't think he was doing a good job really depicting the people. But I wanted to show you the different impressions that people did have. And you can see some of the regalia and the flicker board. It's that board that's right here that you saw on the others. That's hanging off of him, not really in the right way. But there were other people who came through that did do the drawing. Well, in 1860s, the Kashaya are still living a very traditional lifestyle. And I can tell you today, the Kashaya still live in that way. Often. And I recently hired a Kashaya woman, the first time we've ever hired a Kashaya at Fort Ross. And she wanted to be there, wanted to be and do and work with the kids, and she is, and she lives very traditional. She gathers, she eats traditional foods all the time. They have ceremonies, they have things they can do, can't do, things they can share, things they can't share, and her children are growing up with all of that. This is an aunt of hers, a great aunt, Annie Jarvis. She's well known in the Kashaya Pomo Healdsburg Pomo world. And you can see she is leaching the acorn meal in the water. And then she'll be adding salt, and that's a salt basket that she has. But I just wanted to share with you that it didn't go away, that the influence that the Russian-American company had with these people was very, again, passive. So the picture of Billy Reen right here, we work really closely with Billy Reen. When we were in Russia, we went to the Kunstkamera, which has the largest collection of Kashaya regalia and artifacts, just everyday tools and everyday adornment. That's in St. Petersburg. Does everyone kind of know of that place a little bit? It's an amazing place, and the Kashaya, it was their dream to go see it. The ones that, when we went and we spent 3 days there with the curators, we were taken back by Billy Reen. She's a very pure Kashaya. Her father and her mother were Kashaya. Her mother had a little bit of Coast Miwok. That's all. So she's of the native lineage, and she wears the same adornment. Look at the woman in the case that at the Kunstkamera that she had never seen before. Look at her necklace. Isn't that powerful? I mean, I think that it's like we were like in tears. And then Martina is the gal that I recently hired. And she had, she's actually doing a poetry read next weekend at Fort Ross of her Kashaya, I call it Kashayaness. And she had written this poem for our trip and read this poem at every meeting that we had. And this is the moment that those men in the ministry cried, because it was so moving and so touching to them. So it's very powerful what's going on today. And so back then, their everyday life, the Kashaya, the collection at the Kunstkamera is from Ilya Voznesensky in 1841. And again, it's the largest collection of artifacts of that era that exists in the world today. And most of the items, and we didn't know this until I started saying we're coming, we want to see things, they have a, they call it a depot, a warehouse, with over 600 objects that no one's ever seen. And so we're getting funds for the Kashaya to go back and to look at those items and name them. The immediate moment when we saw the cases is they had some things misnamed. And Lester, who is an elder, was right away able to say, well, that actually goes across the face and it's called this. And they were like, and the curator, I'm not joking, and I cry a lot, so everyone says, oh, you just think everyone cries. He cried. That was his life work. And he had never talked to a Kashaya to get the right information. And the Kashaya went to him and said, this is what it is. And he cried. He says, he had to turn away because he says, we don't cry, but it was very moving. And he said he would never see those objects again the same that after that day, that they were alive, that those objects were not objects. And so what came out on the table are things that had never been seen. And again, that's like 20 items on that table, a penny whistle, a hair thing, and a lip thing, and earrings, and it's very powerful, and we actually are working towards getting a grant to bring this collection to the Sonoma County Museum. We're working closely with them to get it here. And it will never come back here and stay here. The Kashaya cannot repatriate that, and that will be the agreement, and they have to agree to it, because they can. if an item comes back into their neighborhood, they could say that's ours. So there's going to be signed contracts and legal and all this good stuff.
What is that? Is that a basket?
That's a basket. It's a gathering basket.
You wear it on your back,
and the band is on your head, and you gather. And the cloak is made of feathers. You might think it's like some kind of wool. It's feather. So it is wow. It's very powerful.
Is it warm?
Yeah, I think it would be very warm. So Kashaya basketry, it's a big part of their life. It is today. In fact, I saw Martina this morning. She says, "Oh, take my basket." I go, "No, you'll come and talk to them and bring your basket." And this one was in the Kunstkamera, but this one is very, very typical of ones that are used even today. These are items from Langsdorff's journal. These he collected as well. And these are items that are also in that collection, so not just Voznesensky, but Langsdorff. And he describes them, talks about them, and labels them, but again, incorrectly. So the earring that's at the bottom, you guys like, do you think it's nice? It's a nice earring, right? It's amber. And black and white beads were very powerful, something that the Kashaya wanted. But these earrings actually also the Native Alaskans liked. And so these earrings are from a Kodiak woman from the cemetery. And I have it today to show you. So we'll look at that at the end. Well, I want to talk a little bit about the everyday life and the Russian officers, and we don't know exactly their life, and in fact, we always know more about the officers than we do the everyday laborers, because they could write, and others didn't have a written language. So Baranov, you may know this name, he is kind of short and bald, pretty bald. And he was the guy that created the Russian-American company and made it work. When you talk about a dedicated employee, that's him. He stayed there in Kodiak through a winter with very little food. His hut was leaking while he had sent for supplies in Russia, and they never came back before the winter. And so he just did his work as best he could. And then that's when they decided to try to get into the Sitka area, which is Tlingit people. And the Tlingit actually fought them off twice and won. And that's also another story. But Baranov had to negotiate with the Tlingit. And that was one of his first times he had to negotiate with Native people. And then his idea about Native people changed after that. Like, wow, these are real people. These are powerful people. These are people with an idea. And so his word to everyone was, treat them well. Treat them kind. And they will help you. Because he survived because of the Native Alaskan people helping him survive. Now, Razanov, you might know this name, but if you don't, again, that is a whole story. That's the love story of Doña Concepcion de Arguello, the daughter of Don Arguello, the manager or commandant at the Presidio at San Francisco. The daughter was just turning 15. Well, Razanov came into San Francisco in 1806 looking for supplies. And the father was away in Monterey on business, so the son was in charge of this moment when the ship arrived. And the bigger picture is that Spain and Russia are allies against France, Napoleon. And because it's a Russian company, he thought, Mom, shouldn't I mean, there's documents, there's a letter that he wrote to his dad saying, I thought I did the right thing. I asked Mama, and she thought that we should allow them in and not turn them away. And while he was gone, and that is a moment in history, I think, defining that they welcomed these Russian guys into their home, and and treated them well, and the Russians gave gifts to the wife of the officer of silk. That is so smart. What do women love? Dress? I need new cloth. And she was like not getting any goods from Spain, because that's where the goods would have come from. And she's like, anyway, Don Arguello, why are we in San Francisco? And when are we leaving? Because it was the most distant outpost from Spain. And at that moment in 1806, there's about 200 people, and half of them you don't want to know, probably, for her. And so by the time Don Arguello got back, the wife and the son, they had partied with the Russians, and oh, they're really good guys. And I'm sure she said, I don't know what your policy is, but mine, personal policy, is we're going to trade with these people, because it wasn't allowed. According to Spain, trade was not allowed, and do not trade with anybody. And so it was really not sanctioned by Madrid. And but if you're in San Francisco and Madrid is far away, you're going to do what you do to live and survive. And the priests also felt that way. And that they said, they saw the ship in the bay, and they actually flocked to the Presidio to meet them. And who are you? What do you have? We need goods. We need iron. We need sugar. We need the, you know, everything, the whole normal list. And Rezanov said, yeah, I could provide this. I want this trade. And that was that. And by the time Don Arguello got back, everybody's mind had been made up. So too bad for him. So Rezanov, the story with the daughter is she was just turning 15. And 15 in Latin tradition, it's a very big birthday. And they partied for days. And Doña Concepcion also could not stand her lifestyle and wanted out, and thought that maybe he's the ticket out. He's just 40, and his wife had died about 5 years before, and she's turning 15. And she's coming to him at night, no hanky-panky, I promise, at least it's not in the letters. But she was telling him what to say to her dad for the next meeting. She would sit in on her dad's meetings and conversations and then go to him and say, this is what daddy said. This is what you should do. This is how you should approach it. And that's what he did. And he wrote about it. And the beauty of San Francisco talking to him and telling him everything that he needed to know. So they did fall in love in the way that you do or did. And she had her own agenda and he had his. But he had gone back to Russia for permission and died on his way near Irkutsk. Never came back, of course, but Kuskov came back 2 years later and told the family what happened. And they said, okay, good, you're going to marry who we told you to marry anyway. So get off your high horse about Rezanov. That's over. And she says no. And she became the first nun in California. And she's buried in Benicia, and she is really honored in the Catholic traditions. So that's everyday life, right? In a way.
Was she Spanish?
She was Spanish, yes.
Mm-hmm. What language did they speak?
Well, that is French, actually. Quite often it was French. Yeah, it's a great question.